The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning, everyone. That's a nice rousing response from a big crowd here. I'm Dan Metcalf of the Collaboration on Government Secrecy, or CGS for short, here at the Washington College of Law at American University in Washington, D.C. And I'd like to welcome everyone to our anniversary celebration, so to speak. This is January 20th, of course. It's the one-year anniversary of the inauguration of President Obama. 1 year ago today, during his inaugural speech, he talked about doing business in the light of day. And then immediately following that, as everyone knows very famously in his day one memoranda, he spoke even more eloquently and more extensively about transparency and participatory government and accountability and even collaboration, which does seem to be the word du jour someday. And we're here to take a look, first and foremost, to celebrate that one-year anniversary and to take a look at how things have gone with respect to transparency during the past year, and also to look forward to how things should continue to develop in everyone's estimation during the coming months and years ahead. And I'm very pleased to be able to say that the Collaboration on Government Secrecy, which began here just 2.5 years ago, is now celebrating or conducting its 10th program like this. We started in September of 2007. Celebrating International Right to Know Day, which everyone knows, of course, is September 28th. And we're going to have another program on FOI Day, March 16th. As a matter of fact, everyone should have been able to see for display up above, at the point at which we have the handouts, the preliminary flyer we have for that program on March 16th. We're now the principal place of celebrating annual FOI Day on James Madison's birthday each year. And this year we're going to have as our keynote speaker John Podesta, former White House Chief of Staff during the Clinton administration and Obama-Biden transition team head. And John will be receiving this year the Robert Vaughn Foy Legend Award, the third time it's been given. The second time was just last year, when it was presented to Senator Leahy, and we expect that Senator Leahy will be coming on March 16th and present that award to John. We now have programs on fixed dates. On September 28th, International Right to Know Day, March 16th, Freedom of Information Day, and this now today marks the third of our series of programs, likewise on a fixed date, in that this is the first year assessment on January 20th, 2010, and what we're looking forward to is the second year assessment on Thursday, January 20th, 2011, and the third year on Friday, January 20th, 2012, and then we'll go from there. So this is something that we are institutionalizing as a means of not only gauging how things have been going lately in different perspectives and estimations, but also to let the Obama administration know that the openness and government community indeed is very interested in doing this sort of thing on an annual basis. And for that purpose, what we've done, and this was something we started in August, we started the Obama administration Secrecy Transparency Scorecard. And the very beginning of that, you can see on the middle screen behind us here, that reflects both grades in individual areas and an overall grade, which now stands as at C+, as well as contains a lot of detailed information about things on both the secrecy side and the transparency side of the ledger, so to speak. Now, I should probably hasten to add that it says secrecy/transparency scorecard only because thus far the secrecy side predominates. But we fully expect, as do I think most people in the room today and our website viewers, that with time, with sufficient time, that balance will shift. And we can then rename it the Obama Administration Transparency Secrecy Scorecard. It takes time in government for things to move forward and to move forward effectively, and everyone has to bear that in mind. So it's with that spirit that we are keeping track here at the Collaboration on Government Secrecy of that information. I'll also mention that for purposes of today's program, we developed an extensive new section of the CGS website, which is on national security classification. It's something that builds upon or stems from the fact that the new executive order on national security classification was issued just at the end of December, December 29th. And one of the Dean's Fellows who works as a senior researcher, one of the students here for the CGS team, LaToya Rembert-Lang, worked very hard to get that portion, that big section of the CGS website up for purposes of this program, because we're going to be having a panel focusing on the new executive order this afternoon. And immediately following that portion of the website, you may also see that we have a new state secrets privilege part of the website, which was developed for purposes of the state secrets conference that we had here on November 18th. And for any of you interested in that subject in particular or the subjects of any other prior CGS programs, I just want to flag for you that you could go to the bottom of the CGS site where it says podcasts and more to the point webcasts, and you can link into webcasts of all of the programs. So you can see exactly what we've been doing, session, program after program after program. Now today, at today's program, we're going to have four panels. In the middle of the day, we're going to have a luncheon speaker. I don't know how many of you have heard Mike Isikoff speak. Mike is the investigative correspondent for Newsweek, and he also has recently become a contributor for MSNBC. Mike has privately confided to me that he finds the mainstream media somewhat confining or constraining as to what he can say, even on cable, which is where he now is on MSNBC, and he likes nothing more than to have an audience here where he can sort of let down his hair, so to speak, and also respond to questions, and there's no telling what Mike might say and what secrets he knows that you can ask about. In our panels today, I'll just give you a highlight. We have a number of people, including an expert on FOIA policy implementation on the first panel. We have the new director, the founding director of the new Office of Government Information Services here for that panel. We have for the classification panel the NSC, National Security Council official, who was the lead official working on that. With apologies to National Security Advisor General Jones, I think Bill Leary can probably claim that title. And we also have someone from the Office of Director of National Intelligence who actually still works for the CIA, although it's not entirely clear what that capacity is. There's some rumor that she used to share an office with Valerie Plame earlier in her career. We're not too sure about that. We have her for that panel. And then for the last panel, that includes someone who is at ground zero, so to speak, with respect to the Open Government Directive. That's the directive that was issued on December 9th, and that identifies the location within the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, which is sort of ground zero for its implementation, and we have the director, the chief of that branch of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs as part of our panel here to speak with respect to that. So we've got a good program here today, but before any of that, we get to start off with our opening keynote speaker. Now, you may note that Beth Novick, who many of you know or have worked with or heard of, someone who is sort of one of the key people with respect to the Openness in Government Directive and the Open Government Initiative at the White House. Beth, who's a new mom, had a bit of a complication. She gave birth not just to the Open Government Directive in December, she also gave birth in the more natural sense of that word. So we're very pleased that with that complication, we have someone who is, without any doubt, at least second best to speak to that. And as a matter of fact, you might even conclude, after hearing her speak this morning, that second best is an underestimation. We have with us Robin Sturm, who literally works hand-in-hand with Beth Novick and has done that since February of this year, since joining the Obama administration. She's someone with a varied background in public policy work and very well positioned to do the type of hard work that they've been doing. I'm going to guess, Robin, maybe 18 hours a day, give or take. Is that an underestimation, perhaps? I know she and I were emailing very, very late last night, and Beth emailed me at 4 o'clock in the morning. They do work hard in government. Make no mistake about that. And those of you who are government employees, I think you know that very well. And Robin's background includes not only working in India on social policy matters, but also working for Senator Patrick Leahy on the Senate Judiciary Committee. She holds her BA and MA on political science from Yale and also is a graduate of Yale Law School. She's someone who has graciously agreed to come and speak to this subject matter on relatively short notice. And I know that she's interested in any questions you have, not only for purposes of facilitating this program, but also for purposes of facilitating her own work. Because much of what they do now, much of what the thrust is to interact with members of the public, so to speak, members of the openness and government community. So through your questions, we can have a dialogue, perhaps, that can help inform what is done in the year to come. And the one final thing I'll mention is that Robin told me confidentially this morning that she's spoken in a number of different forums, and she sometimes comes away disappointed when people don't ask hard questions. So I assured her that she had nothing to worry about here, that we have two microphones on the side, and that we have people who will be asking her at least a few hard, easy, somewhere in the middle questions as we go along and toward the end. So please join me in welcoming our keynote speaker, Robin Sturm.
Thank you so much for that. It's a real pleasure to be here with all of you today. And very exciting to be celebrating 1 year of transparency in the Obama administration. I'm going to start with a little bit of ground that Dan's already covered, just to bring everyone up to speed and on the same page, but I suspect there's a lot of experts in the room, so I'll move pretty quickly to more of the meat. So, as you all know, nearly a year ago tomorrow, the President signed as his first executive action the Memorandum on Transparency and Open Government. In it, he called for an unprecedented level of openness in government. And 1 month later, I joined the Obama administration with this daunting task of actually figuring out how to make that real and in practice and in the everyday work of agencies across the government. In his call for transparency, the President talks about three functions of transparency that I think are worth fleshing out a little bit, in part because the group of the team of us who work on transparency and open government in the administration spans many parts of the White House, and there's different pieces of the transparency portfolio that are handled by my colleagues in White House Counsel and OMB and in other places. And so by helping to kind of tease out these various functions, I think it will help to both understand how it works as well as what we're trying to achieve. So first, the President placed emphasis on accountability. He put accountability at the center of his governing philosophy, and he looked to transparency as a mechanism to that end, stressing, of course, the famous words that sunlight is the best of disinfectants. Second, we'll talk about the way that transparency can be used to ensure that institutions benefit from widely dispersed knowledge throughout society. And third, we'll talk about the way that transparency can make sure that people across the country have access to information that they can readily find and use, and what that means for their lives. So since day one, the administration has been implementing these values in ways that actually touch, the lives of many Americans. So first I'll talk about transparency as a disinfectant. When the president quoted Justice Brandeis's words, he referred to the principle of accountability with the basic idea that accountability, that government officials should be held accountability, and that transparency is required for that. He also, as many of you know, put that into practice by establishing very firmly a presumption of disclosure when it comes to FOIA, saying that, quote, the government should not keep information confidential merely because public officials might be embarrassed by disclosure, because errors and failures might be revealed, or because of speculative or abstract fears. Non-disclosure should never be based on an effort to protect the personal interests of government at the expense of those they are supposed to serve. And I think that that's really useful for thinking about the entire portfolio of the ways that transparency promotes accountability. And that's definitely true in terms of some of the concrete steps that we've taken over the past year towards that goal. So one that I would point out in particular is that for the very first time, the White House is now publishing all of the logs of the visitors who come to the White House, and this provides a unique view into the policymaking process. There has each month tens of thousands of records of visitors from the previous 90 to 120 days are now made available online. This is phenomenal if you think about the various issues that White House officials are working on and being able to say to the public, everyone that we're talking to, everyone that we're listening to, the people who are shaping the ways that we think and the policies that we write, we want you to know who they are and how much time we're spending with them. So I think that is one clear step that the administration has taken. Another field that I would point to is the way that the administration has taken steps to track taxpayer dollars. And they've been doing it with easy-to-understand websites like recovery.gov, usaspending.gov, as well as the Federal IT Dashboard. I'll focus for just a moment on the Federal IT Dashboard because I think it's a really powerful example. It basically allows anyone with a web browser to track the $70 billion worth of investments in information technology that the federal government makes each year. Graphs display project performance against schedule, costs, and stated objectives. This is in stark contrast to the approach that was previously taken towards information technology, which often led to systems that were mismanaged, poorly planned, or ill-conceived from the start. And even though it's only 6 months old, the IT dashboard's already changed in the way in which agencies manage their IT investments. For example, in July, the Department of Veterans Affairs announced it would temporarily halt 45 IT projects that were either found to be behind schedule or over budget. And after a thorough review, 12 of these projects were actually canceled. And they were able to catch these from the start. So that's important from an accountability perspective internally. But to make it clear, this is available to everyone publicly, along with the individual who's responsible for these individual accounts, these individual projects. And it provides very clear accountability to the American public with regards to government performance. Moving to the second function of transparency, the ability to ensure that institutions are able to take advantage of widely dispersed knowledge in society. So the president has talked often about the need to tap the knowledge and expertise of the public as well as with frontline workers, knowing that being able to do so is important to ensure the highest quality decisions based on the best possible information. And today we have the great advantage of being able to have the level of connectivity and some new social media tools and technologies that allow us to do that in real time with a larger number of people and a broader set of stakeholders than ever before. To give you a couple examples, I'll look both inside and outside the government. Inside the government, I would point you to the VBA Innovation Initiative. The Veterans Affairs has long faced many problems with administering the benefits to the men and women who serve our country in the theater of war. And they've traditionally had lots of backlogs and delays in terms of being able to process and determine whether or not an individual is eligible for benefits and then being able to serve that individual appropriately. So in the summer, the president challenged he looked to the frontline workers for solutions about how to actually fix this intractable problem. And he began by challenging the 19,000 workers who actually process these benefits applications to come up with the best ideas about how to streamline the process and to solve the problem. Of the 19,000 employees who were eligible to participate because of their knowledge, 12,000 started submitting ideas to the online brainstorming tool in the very first 24 hours. It was a really powerful response and showed that there was much information, much knowledge, much energy, and much desire to change the way the government works that had been untapped to date. Over the course of the past 6 months, those ideas have been going through a process that ultimately culminated in the very top ideas being presented to the Secretary of the VA himself, who has identified the very best of those ideas and committed to actually implement them and put them in place. And that will be coming out in the next couple weeks. Another example, which many of you would be, which also falls in, along these lines in terms of tapping the expertise of frontline workers within government, is the SAVE Award that many of you know that crowdsourced the best ideas for how to save money from federal employees across the government. 40,000 ideas were submitted, and the public was empowered to select the best idea from the top five finalists. Also, the Green Gov did something very similar for thinking about ways that we can make government more environmentally friendly. But in addition to tapping the expertise of frontline workers, we're also looking to do so for members of the public, wherever they live across the country. And there's been many examples of that in the past year as well. As agencies begin to experiment with new ways of open policymaking, new ways of being able to gain the insights of experts in various places where they live. So one is ongoing now, and I'll point to it because it's an opportunity to participate that's currently open, which is the Public Access Policy Forum. So there's a question about whether and how the government should make peer-reviewed scholarly articles available when they flow from the fruits of federally funded research. NIH currently has a policy that has been in place that mandates that any scholarly journal article that flows from federally funded research needs to be made available to the public within 12 months. And so the question is whether or not that should be applied to additional agencies, and if so, how, and what are the technical questions that come up in terms of the design of the policy and its implementation and compliance. And so to answer these tricky questions, we've turned to the public, to all of you, to engage. And over the past 6 weeks, we've been doing a process through the OSTP blog that presents questions, seeks answers, and the input has just been absolutely overwhelming in terms of the quantity, but also the quality. And the interactive nature means that participants can not only offer their two cents, but they can respond to the ideas of others, they can rebut arguments, they can raise questions to their peers, they can link to the articles that they've published, to resources that we should be looking at and thinking about, and other knowledge and information on the web in a way that would be very difficult to do through a traditional process. So this is just one of the many ways in which this administration is opening up the policymaking process. What we're now doing with the question of public access has also been done with regards to health IT, with regards to education reform, and many other important issues over the past year.
Robin, if I could just interject, for purposes of anyone in the audience who might not know what the OSTP blog is, that refers to the Office of Science and Technology Policy within the Executive Office of the President, which has taken the very strong lead with respect to transparency initiatives within the White House. So if you see OSTP, that's something that has become almost synonymous with open government at this stage.
Thank you for that. And to put context, the reason for that is because in the President's memorandum that he issued on the first day, he charged the Chief Technology Officer with engaging the public to come up with recommendations for the Open Government Directive. And so as the Chief Technology Officer sits within the Office of Science and Technology Policy in the White House, that has been a source for much of the experimentation and innovation around policymaking from the administration. Thank you for that. At this point, I want to turn to the third function of transparency, which is talking about the way that government can be a platform to make sure that to increase access to information that the public can readily find and use. So the administration launched data.gov in May with just 47 data sets. As of December, we had over 118,000 that are now available to the public that hadn't previously been. They're all available freely in machine-readable format, which makes it easy for developers and researchers to use it, to mash it up, to visualize it in ways that couldn't have happened before. This number will be exploding with the Open Government Directive that was issued in December, something I'm going to talk about a little bit more in just a moment. But I want to emphasize the value of this data, because it is key. Just as we're opening our doors to the American people, I believe that transparency is fundamentally about opening our data to the American people, to seeing it as the president called it, a true national asset alongside our national parks and other things that are clearly recognized as treasure troves of value. And the reason is because by actually releasing this data, it unleashes the ingenuity and innovation and entrepreneurship in the private sector that then enables collaboration to help us to achieve the goals that we've set out, such that, as the president recognized, the government cannot do it alone. We absolutely need all hands on deck. So, for example, in December, one of the data sets that was released right after the directive is a data set on the nutritional value for the 1,000 most commonly eaten foods. And this is made available in a machine-readable format. And with this data that's now available, the USDA is challenging video game makers and developers and students across the country to create video games that actually will help children make healthy eating decisions. So thinking about the ways that you can use the new digital media and use this data to create very precise, very sound tools, but that also are utilizing new technologies to engage children to further learning, whether it be about healthy eating habits or whether it be about science and math education, which is another initiative that's very similar. Other examples include in December, the government made workplace safety information available for the first time, and by doing that, they're able to help keep America's workers out of harm's way by creating incentives for employers that have occupational fatalities to immediately take action to address the potential dangers, and also for those employers who are looking progressively towards prevention to see the problems that arise and to be able to take steps in advance to make sure that those things don't happen to their own workers. By making information on the status and causes of airports delays available, the government enabled travelers to better plan their days. There's hundreds of these examples, and they range from the very serious to the very mundane in terms of just making our lives work better. And so those are the three functions of transparency that we've been working on over the past year. All of these have been institutionalized in an important way in the Open Government Directive, which came out in early December. And so I want to turn to that now, because it is by far the most expansive step that the Obama administration has taken in order to institutionalize the values of openness, the values of transparency, participation, and collaboration in government. So, in December, the White House issued an Open Government Directive instructing all agencies to take immediate and specific steps to open their doors and data to the American people. This stemmed largely from an unprecedented open policymaking effort that we did in the summer of 2009 out of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. So it was a three-phase process that lasted over 6 weeks that allowed the public to brainstorm ideas, to discuss them in depth, and finally to collaboratively draft suggested language for the recommendations for the directive. In all, we had thousands of people engaged in this form of open government policymaking, and their fingerprints, your fingerprints, are all over the directive that came out in December, and we're very proud of that. It couldn't have been what it is without you, so thank you for all of your participation. So what does the directive do, and why are we so excited about it? So the first and foremost, the directive directs agencies to disseminate government information to the public online and to do so in open, accessible, and machine-readable formats. It calls upon agencies to respect the presumption of openness by publishing information in advance of any Freedom of Information Act request and to preserve and maintain electronic information. It directs them to develop a strategic plan for transparency that establishes a timeline for publishing online in open formats new high-value information. And by high-value, we mean information that can be used to increase agency accountability, to spur economic activity, to respond to public demand in terms of the things that you tell us you need to be able to better pursue presidential priorities. The directive also focuses on transparency around specific kinds of information. So, for example, it requires the annual FOIA reports be published online in machine-readable formats. The Department of Justice actually took the lead by publishing their own annual report in an open machine-readable format on the day that the directive was released, and that will soon become common practice under the directive. It also demands that milestones, it also demands that agencies publish online information about how to access declassified agency materials and to solicit public input on what type of materials they should prioritize for declassification for the future. So as you can see, this piece of the directive will be monumental in terms of seeing the number of data sets that are available on data.gov go up exponentially. And this will start with a deadline that is in the very near future, as of January 22nd, the first very specific deadline set out by the directive for this Friday, has a number of different components, but one of which is that every single agency will be publishing 3 high-value data sets on their website. So the second piece of the directive is much broader. It's the goal is much more daunting in some ways. The directive aims to instill the values of transparency, participation, and collaboration into the culture of every agency by requiring every agency to formulate an open government plan and website. And so specifically, we recognize that agencies vary dramatically in terms of what open government should mean for them, and in particular want to make sure that openness is not something that's on the periphery. It's not a box that they check, but rather it's something that's incorporated into the core of their everyday work, that the secretary's top missions, top goals, are achieved better, more efficiently, more legitimately by using open practices in order to create the policies and transparency to share what they're doing. As each agency develops its open government plan, they're going to be reaching out to federal employees and also to all of you, to the American public. This is also something that's required by the directive, that it's not something that should be done behind closed doors, but in participation from the very beginning and then with your feedback as it evolves over the coming years. And importantly, to build on the point that this is something that should be about the fundamental priorities of the top leadership and agency, this should be reflected in terms of the team that is itself implementing and developing the open government plan. So we've asked agencies through the directive to develop an interdisciplinary team to recognize that this is a new field in which there's no one individual that can cover all of the knowledge and expertise that's necessary, that they need to bring in their legal leadership, their policy leadership, their programmatic leadership, also their tech experts and their web experts. Fourth, it calls upon the Office of Management and Budget to review government-wide information policies that need updating or clarifying to allow agencies to utilize new technologies and promote open government fully. And it also calls on OMB to develop a framework for agencies to use challenges, prizes, and other incentive-backed strategies to find innovative and cost-effective solutions. So this part of the directive focuses on the fact that we know that there are entrenched policies that may be preventing agencies from being able to fully take advantage of open approaches and new technologies to be able to do all of the things that we just talked about, and thinking about what tweaks might be necessary and what clarifications will really allow agency action to flourish. So as I mentioned before, under the Open Government Directive, we're on a tight clock. So part of the reason why Dan and I were emailing late last night, this Friday, there's going to be 3 milestones that hit, and they're the first of many. So on February 22nd, agencies will all be publishing their 3 high-value data sets, just 3 of many. But it's an important thing to note, because we wanted to focus not just on sheer volume, but we wanted to focus on data sets that are game changers. We want agencies to think of releasing data as not something that they do to comply with the directive, but instead as something that helps them to achieve their goals, and as something that helps them to find partners throughout the American people to achieve their goals. So similar to the way that Secretary Vilsack has released the nutrition data, so that game developers and game students can help him to fight childhood obesity. The second milestone that comes due on Friday is the deadline that OMB must create an interagency working group to share best practices and help push all of the agencies for a race to the top for the most innovative solutions to open policymaking, to new ways of collaboration, to higher value data sets. And I'm happy to report that that's already in place, and we've been meeting for several weeks, every single week, with representatives from the agencies to make sure that all of this is on track. And then third is that every agency will be designating a senior official who will be in charge of making sure that the data that is released is of very high quality and in full integrity. Coming soon, but not this Friday, thank God, is that the CTO and the CIO have been charged with releasing an open government dashboard. And this is important because the dashboard, and we've talked about dashboards for federal NT investment, and what I mean by that is essentially a very simple way for everyone to know the status, where we're headed, and how far we are from our goals. So the dashboard is meant to track progress and to create a race for the top, to give agencies very clear guidance about what they need to do to succeed. And when we think about that, we think about not only the clear guidance that they need to implement the very specific requirements that are already in the four corners of the document that's posted on the White House website, but also thinking about what things would be concrete and measurable that would ask agencies to stretch and would ask them to think about implementing the directive in a way that fundamentally changes the culture of their agencies in the ways that we aspire to.
Robin, some people might not be familiar with the word dashboard, but I think I can tell you, tell me if I'm incorrect, it's more than a rumor that the word dashboard connects to the speed with which all of this is being done and in the form of making a mad dash to meet one of those milestones or directives. Is that a fair characterization?
I have never heard that before, but that certainly is how I feel.
Okay.
I've also heard the origination of the word to be the car dashboard, where you can quickly take a glance down and see all the vitals of your car. How fast are you going? How's the engine doing? Do you need oil? So that's another way to think about the dashboard.
Back in the day, before dashboards were quite as sophisticated as they are now in automobiles, we used to call certain lights on the dashboard, such as a low oil light, we used to call them idiot lights. In other words, you'd have to be an idiot to ignore that light so that the oil runs out and your engine seizes. I don't think that applies here necessarily, but certainly the mad dash does.
Well, we definitely want to make it easy for every single American to take a quick look and to know whether or not we're delivering on our promises. And we want to make it equally easy for agencies to know whether or not they're shining alongside their peers. And we want to keep setting that bar higher and higher in terms of what that looks like and what it means to shine on the open government dashboard. So that brings me to the third piece. In addition to providing clear guidance, we also want the dashboard to be something that really empowers the public to be able to hold us accountable to the promises that we've made in December. And so I hope that all of you will be a part of that. So I want to go ahead and wrap up so that I can take your very hard questions, as Dan has promised. But I just want to say that it is the first year. We are moving a battleship. It's going to take time, but I am very proud of where we are, and some other people are too. We were really delighted to see that some of the independent government reform groups, the League of Women Voters, USPIRG, Common Cause, and Democracy 21, recently gave us an A for our open government initiatives, saying that it's the strongest and most comprehensive lobbying ethics and transparency rules and policies ever established by an administration. And I don't think that's a bad start. But I also realize that we have a really long way to go in order to achieve the aspiration of the president's vision, because it is so broad and it is so big. And we're going to need all of your help for that. Every single piece of the Open Government Directive hardwires public consultation into the process. We ask agencies to consult the public when they're thinking about what high priority data sets they should make available. And we build into the definition of high value public demand. When we do the same thing with regards to the open government plans and developing those, as well as every single piece of what the plan is trying to achieve. And so I hope that you will come often to whitehouse.gov/open. You will take a look at our dashboard. You will take a look at the many participation opportunities to weigh in, to shape, to influence the way that we're implementing this on a day-to-day basis, because we very much need your help. So with that, I'm here and would be more than delighted to take your questions. It looks like we have 6 or 7 minutes before we hit time. I think if folks with questions could come up to the microphone, I believe this is being recorded and it will better capture your voices.
What we do is we have microphones on both sides of the room here, and while people file up to that, maybe I can exercise a prerogative as conference organizer and ask an easy one just to start. But it's one that's been in a lot of people's minds since last spring. And that is that the President's day one memorandum with respect to transparency in general and the open government directive then prospectively set a 120-day time period that was the basis, I think, for at least some confusion in some respects, because that sort of set a May 21 deadline. And the Open Government Directive, of course, wasn't issued until early December, and everyone understands that things do take longer than expected. But one of the expectations created by the words of that day one memorandum was that there would be an initial stage at which there would be recommendations made, and then perhaps the public would see what the recommendations were and then comment on the recommendations specifically before the directive were issued. And that also does connect a little bit to something that we'll be talking about this afternoon with respect to the executive order on national security. There was an effort, as a matter of fact, our first questioner, Patrice McDermott, was the principal person behind that effort to get the National Security Council to perhaps provide the draft language of the executive order in advance so it could be commented upon with specificity, and that just didn't happen. So I wonder, are you able to speak to exactly how that shifted from what looked like recommendations that would be available in May before the Open Government Directive was issued, and it then kind of jumped all the way to that?
Sure. So the specific language of the directive was called for the recommendations within 120 days, which would be May 21st, and they should be made by the Chief Technology Officer. So the Chief Technology Officer, which he actually came to the job on something like May 17th, I believe.
That's good timing.
just in the nick of time. His recommendation was that recommendations simply can't be created without the input of the public. And so that's why we launched the six-week public consultation process, is we didn't want to come back to you and say, look, we've written it. Any thoughts? But instead, we wanted to change the way that we do the process. And so starting from the very beginning with, we're starting with a blank page. We're thinking about these policies. We want you to start by helping us to define, A, what should be on the table and off the table.
So lest there be any misunderstanding about that, that was the recommendation.
That's correct.
Of the new Chief Technology Officer to start the process that became a very extensive process of public participation over the summer.
Exactly.
Great. Well, why don't we turn to our first questioner over here then.
Patrice McDermott, OpenTheGovernment.org. Hey, Robin. First, I want to congratulate the administration on the directive. I think it lays important new ground. However, here's my hard question. a lot of us are very concerned that there, other than the dashboard that will encourage people to race to the top, there doesn't seem to be any enforcement built into it. There's no clear oversight built into it that the outside can see anyway. And so I think my question to you would be, are you essentially outsourcing enforcement by expecting the public to hold agencies and the White House, the administration accountable, or is there a system of accountability built in within the administration to ensure that these plans are developed and implemented and all the other aspects of it as well?
That's a great question, because why create a number of directives if they're not actually implemented, if you don't see the results, right? So the answer to that is twofold. One is that we absolutely want the public to be a partner in these endeavors, in part because there are going to be specific things that you want and need to see happen that won't necessarily be on the radar of individuals within the White House that would be doing enforcement. So I don't think that it can be, you know, one specific entity alone. Right. But that said, we're definitely not outsourcing the enforcement to the public alone. There is a group of White House stakeholders that have been meeting and working together very closely from the very beginning, both through the development of the content of the directive, and now we'll be working very closely in terms of enforcement. This is a group that takes the ratings on the dashboard and takes enforcement very seriously. So we meet on a very regular basis. It's this group that's going to be leading the interagency work group, where every week the agency representatives are coming in, and it's a mixture of both reporting back in terms of where they are, mm-hmm. With regards to their plans for the deadlines that are coming due, as well as helping to share best practices and ideas about how to further improve those and make them better, solve particular problems, deal with personally identifiable information, these types of things that come up that you don't want to have to happen over and over and over again. And I think also that you should definitely not sell short the dashboard, in the sense that it is not going to be the CTO and the CIO have their names on the dashboard, and they take very seriously their responsibility to make sure that it fully reflects where every single agency is, mm-hmm. in absolute truth at that given moment in time. And we're going to start with the dashboard, focusing very clearly on the core deliverables of the directive, to keep all of the agencies super focused on targets for success during this 120-day dash, as Dan has said. But then we'll expand it to include a number of other measurements, both quantitative as well as qualitative, in terms of agency success.
Right. I'll just note that I believe one of the people of whom Robin spoke will be gathering together regularly is Alexander Hunt, who's the branch chief in OIRA at OMB, and will be on our fourth panel this afternoon.
That's correct. So
you'll be able to see not only this person who speaks about those people who have responsibility for enforcement, you'll be able to talk to a person who does have responsibility for it as well. Question over here.
Yes, hi. I guess I have a comment on your response to this first question. Is having just come from some DOJ training, until agencies are given more money and more FOIA staff, they literally cannot do their job. And my agency's easy. I'm the NLRB. We can do it. But there are some agencies that literally are overwhelmed, and you can scream and yell all you want about the five-year backlog. They can't do their job without more money and staff. Mm-hmm. So that's just a message to the president. Secondly, I have a question about the preserving and maintaining electronic information. One of the issues that I've noticed in the federal government is, you know, we have the Records Retention Act, and the Records Retention Act sort of mandates that after 7 years, records are destroyed. And from a researcher's point of view, I've noticed that especially for my agency, after 7 years, we destroy all records except those that we consider to be worthy of preservation in the archives. Well, you know, from a researcher's point of view, as a former faculty member, if you want to do research of the NLRB back from 1935 and you want to pull those old records out, they don't exist. And so what is the correlation between preserving and maintaining electronic records and the Records Retention Act? And I understand that when we had paper documents, it was too expensive to preserve those. But I think there has to be some thought given to how long you want the agencies to preserve their electronic data.
So this is an issue that is that many people are struggling with across government. As technologies change very quickly, it's become incredibly imperative that we figure out the right path forward with regards to the preservation of electronic records, both in terms of defining what those are as well as figuring out how to preserve them. To complicate your question even further, imagine that it's not just emails, it's not just documents that are on computers, but we now have comments that are on blogs, we have chats that are on Facebook, we have Twitters. that are going back and forth between the White House and the American public. And some of those are on third-party sites, some of them are on .gov sites. And so I think that the entire ball of wax is something that is not a piece of my portfolio directly, and so I can't speak to exactly where we are in the process, but I do know that NARA is working very hard to be able to provide clear guidance in terms of the appropriate way to capture those records and to keep them such that we are able to both create a historical record for the future and that that's not lost as we change to a more digital information system, as well as being able to make sure that those are help to hold us accountable in the future. So, you know, I would say, great question. We're working on it.
Just to let you know.
I'll just note also that with respect to NARA, we do have the benefit of having the General Counsel of the National Archives and Records Administration in the audience today. Gary Stern is not a speaker today, although he has been a CGS speaker, including a luncheon speaker in the past. And Gary, too, likes hard questions. So if you happen, I will not identify him. If you don't know him by sight, you're just going to have to ferret him out, so to speak. But if you happen to catch him at a break, he is a resource available to you as well. And I'm also going to make an adjustment here. I'm going to create an imaginary third line for media questions on this side, because I see, there we go. I see we have a representative of the media from Federal News Radio, Max Kakis. So if you want, you can ask the next question. Max.
Oh, me?
Yes. You are now on the third line.
Okay.
There you go.
Well, thank you, Dan. And good morning, Robin.
Good morning.
My question is actually more by way of pointing out something that that we had been covering for several months and along the lines of transparency and openness, and that was the process over at the Department of Homeland Security regarding their quadrennial security review that's currently they're currently compiling all the data from having done that. And the interesting thing there was the process that was involved. They used the tools of some people call it social media. The term's kind of going away because a lot of people are now mm-hmm. calling it collaboration. But they used more of a blog-like process where people could contribute comments and then comment back on their comments. And then they basically winnowed down ideas and continued this process of including a very large group of people, both official stakeholders, but also people from the outside who are very interested in this sort of thing. And I'm wondering if the experience that they had, I had a chance to talk to the gentleman over at DHS who shepherded that process through. And they're very have some very positive results from that. I was wondering if the White House has had a chance to look at that. I know that they're going to be issuing the report in the next couple of weeks here from the Quadrennial Security Review. But is there a page in the way that DHS did that process that the White House can maybe use in some of its future policymaking in the next year, 3 years or so? Because it seemed like that worked out very, very well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your comment. So I haven't personally been involved in the Quadrennial Security Review or the process by which they sought public consultation, but I can say that many of the features and the functionality and the opportunities to engage that you've just mentioned in that process are fairly similar to some of the ones that we've used within the White House and that have been used across agencies. I would direct people to the White House Innovations Gallery. It's on whitehouse.gov/open/innovations, and there we're trying to capture all of these innovative ways that agencies are completely rethinking and transforming policymaking. And they vary. They include, as you said, use of social media tools. So, for example, when NARA wanted to take input on the declassification issues, they did so on the OSTP blog in a way that they presented specific questions, received feedback, allowed people to respond to each other, allowed people to rank and rate each other's comments. And would then summarize kind of what was learned so far, move on to the next question, and very methodically move through the issues in that way. You also see, for example, HHS, data.gov, the FCC are all using a brainstorming tool, which happens to be IdeaScale. There are many that are in the market that are fantastic, that allow essentially what you and your team would do with a whiteboard in front of you. It allows you to do it online with hundreds of thousands of people to say, oh, I have an idea, and then help flesh it out by providing some comments, update the idea, really start to crystallize it, and then allow people to vote so that the community itself is helping to moderate such that the best idea is raised to the top. That's something that you'll see in a lot of the engagement plans that are going to be implemented by agencies as they work towards their open government plan this spring. I think you'll see many of those tools employed, and it's something that we are very supportive of. In the White House, we're starting to implement and experiment with already within the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy blog, where we have the technical capacity to do so, and there are larger plans for whitehouse.gov as well.
Okay, we'll go quickly to the lady we skipped over a moment ago when we created that imaginary third media line.
Yes, thank you, ma'am. Professor Metcalf. Hello, my name is Latoya Lang, and I'm part of CGS, so thank you for speaking with us today. My question is in regards to the Open Government Directive. It specifically mentions a backlog reduction of 10%. Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether or not OMB will be actively working on that, including working with OGIS to reduce the backlog.
Yes.
Okay.
When I said quick question,
that was
quite a prediction.
Absolutely. It's in the directive. Every single thing that's in the directive will have our eyes and ears in terms of making sure that we have a plan and we're on point to achieve it in the deadlines that are set out.
And it sounds like OMB will be playing a very heavy role on that. And we can talk about that further with the panel member this afternoon. We have time for just two more quick questions, and we'll shift back over to this side of the room.
Robin. Bert Wise with Wise and Associates. I want to thank you for all your hard work. I'm sure that trying to push openness at the top of the executive branch makes the salmon swimming upstream to spawn seem like a bagatelle. But in order not to disappoint either of you in your hope for tough questions, I'd like to follow up on Patrice. You mentioned that a number of eminent good government groups have given an A to the effort. I think that relates primarily to the packaging and the pronouncements, but a number of equally eminent groups have given the administration grades in the D range for some of the implementation so far. In other words, how this has been put into practice.
For the record, CGS has it as an overall C+. I don't mean to imply that low.
And I think that partly this is inevitably because any broad statements like that will have to have a number of caveats and conditions and so forth. But I think in large part, especially in the national security area, it's because the practices, specific cases, have been so contrary to the bold pronouncements, particularly in the state secrets area, but also to some extent in concrete examples of Freedom of Information Act decisions and even some extent executive order classification decisions. And I think that the overall feeling, I would sum up as Newton's first law, an object put into motion keeps going until met by an adequate opposing force, and that for the time being, the Bush administration's policies are the object in motion. So the question is, you mentioned the White House working group, White House Enforcement Working Group, which I guess translates as CREW. When these kinds of questions come up in those national security areas, does your group ever get a chance to make input? And if that's unrealistic, when there's a reaction by outside experts that they just seem to be doing what Bush said and people don't see this reform, what kinds of steps do you take, if any, to see how that can be changed?
I'm guessing that our speaker is going to say first and foremost that that's a big part of turning that battleship around that she spoke of earlier. It's not just procedural, but it's both substantive, and it does take time. But I don't want to presume what you'd say.
Thank you for that. Do you want to keep going?
No.
What will I say next?
I will tell you just briefly We had an expression back when Janet Reno issued the Reno FOIA memorandum in October of 1993, and the expression was turning that aircraft carrier around. Now, I don't know which is bigger. I had too high a draft number to have been in the Navy. I don't know which is bigger, a battleship or an aircraft carrier, but I know either one is hard to turn around. And that has, again, both the substantive and the procedural aspect. So that's a big part of what you're dealing with.
That's a huge part, especially around FOIA. I mean, the President has sent a very clear message. It was underscored by the Attorney General as well. And we are, you know, doing internal tracking and are happy to report that we see improvement on FOIA in terms of the numbers, and we're going to be making those public soon so that we can share them with all of you. But fundamentally, FOIA requires a change in culture. It requires a change in culture at the general counsel level and every single agency in terms of what their instincts are when they get a FOIA request, as well as making sure that, as the directive requires, that most of the information actually goes out before it's requested. And that is very much so a problem of turning a battleship. But there's another piece there, too, that I will just flag quickly because I know we're running out of time, which is transparency is hard, and there are competing values that we take very seriously, including national security. And so as we figure out kind of the right balance between those two, we want to make sure to move cautiously and to do so in a very considered way and with the appropriate outcomes. And the state secrets policy that came out earlier this fall was an important step in that direction. It greatly enhanced the internal review within government. It was highly praised by many groups. And at this time, we think that that's an important step forward in that direction in terms of setting the stage and starting to set the parameters by which those two should be balanced.
And we have our final patient, most patient questioner, right over there with the final quick question of the morning.
Hi, I'm Amy Bennett with OpenTheGovernment.org. And first, thank you for your work over the last year and for being here today. You described the policy as being hardwired in, but at the end of the day, or actually at the end of the presidential term, it is still just a policy. Thinking back to your time in Chairman Leahy's office, are there any parts of the policy that you think could or should be written into law?
So I think that we've been focused.
You're on your own on this one.
So we've been focused primarily on the things that we can do within the executive branch because it's what we have the most control over, obviously, and because a lot of these are fundamental questions about the way that we execute existing laws, ways that we understand and provide guidance to agencies on existing laws. I think the Paperwork Reduction Act is a really, you know, great example of that, that can, you know, turn the way that you either have greater public consultation or not, depending on interpretation. So I think that there's a lot that we can do. And generally, from where I sit, I allow Congress to do Congress's work, and we focus on kind of the levers that we have at our disposal. That doesn't mean that there aren't ways that they could further amplify and augment the things that we're doing, but it's not at the top of the agenda that we're setting out to kind of fill our 24-hour periods over the next 120 days at the very least. In part because if you look through the directive, I think the things that are there are real and meaningful if they're actually implemented in a really substantial way. And so keeping our energies super focused in terms of making clear to agencies both what the what that looks like and how to do it such that it's possible and not and doesn't seem like something that they'd rather check the box on. And then and also kind of what the upsides are in terms of this being an issue that the administration fundamentally cares about is something that will require a great deal of focus for the next 120 days, and perhaps there'll be more thought about other branches after that.
Yeah, Amy, we had an expression during the first Reagan administration. We sometimes would refer to things as second-term stuff. And then Dick Huff and I back then in the early 80s, we would, during the second Reagan term, we would sometimes refer to things which seemed so, shall we say, extreme as third-term stuff. It may well be that this falls into the category of second-term stuff for purposes of the Obama administration. And on that positive note, let me thank Robin. Let's all please thank her very, very much.
Thank you.
For filling in so ably on relatively short notice and doing such a good job and with her patient response to your questions. What we're going to do now is take a very quick sort of stretch break right in place. We're not looking for anyone to leave the room necessarily as we set up for the first of the four panels of the day.